know what's impressive about this song is that the breaks in between the guitar riffs are just the right amount of time. Not too long, not too short. I wouldn't know how to do that.
That does not surprise me.
I would go to one of the breaks and I just go, just wait a while.
Who is this, Jazz?
Justin Timberlake, Like I Love You.
I gotta give this guy credit. I was never a fan of his, and then when he hosted Saturday Night Live.
One of the best hosts ever on Saturday Night Live. Yeah, he's really talented.
Wow.
When you first saw him, you didn't think he would be such a driving force for so many years.
I sure
did. But he has been. He's a really good actor.
I know.
Great musician. Highlight player.
Something to strive for.
Baker.
Candlestick maker?
I think he's made some candlesticks, too. I have to ask you a question. Yesterday, they showed these two statues in front of Soldier Field. One of the great Walter Payton. Some would say, and I would be on their side, the greatest NFL player of all time.
Yep.
And George Papa Bear Hallis. And there's these giant statues of them. And they're each doing something representative of themselves. Walter Payton has a football in one hand, and he's kind of looking off as if to say, I wonder which way I'll run so that guys can try to tackle me, but they won't be able to tackle me. He's got that look in his eyes, you know? George Hallis is, he's doing what I think most people would know him best for, is coaching. He's got his finger up. He's like pointing at some guy like, cover that guy, cover that guy. My question to you is, when they put up a statue of you, Wendy, and they will at some point put up a statue of you, what will your statue be doing?
Smoking and drinking. Probably.
Yep.
Pointing to a liquor store,
yep,
and a mini mart.
Yep. And not swearing, but getting ready to swear. Not quite mid-swear.
I have tamed my swearing considerably.
It has gone down.
You know, you are good for me. You make me a better man.
Well, Bill's good for everybody.
Well,
really.
No, thank you, Steve. That's
because
nice.
The fact that you said I swore more than anyone you ever met.
Yes.
That made me want to hold back a little bit.
Yes. And you and to your credit, you have. Your swearing has been curtailed, by my estimates, 41% over this time last year. That's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
Does that keep her in the lead, Bill?
Still in the lead. You know who's in second place? Lumberjacks, followed by Vikings.
Where are sailors on that?
Sailors are fourth. Carnival workers fifth. So you're...
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah. You're in good company. Very good company. Steve, when they put up the statue of you, Steve, what will your statue be doing?
Boy, that's a really unfair question.
Tough one, isn't it?
You can't think about it. You have to just answer. You had time when he asked me.
I didn't know you were going to ask me. I have no idea, really. Mm. I don't know what they would be doing.
What an honor that must be, though.
Although, why did it take so long?
Statues, I believe, are always done posthumously, aren't they?
No.
Uh-huh. No?
No, Stan Mikita's was up.
Ernie
Michael
Banks.
Jordan.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess you're right.
I think you're statues are new, fairly new.
Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're new as in the Michael Jordan one was with the United Center, right? So that was sort of the house that Jordan built. But the Hawks statues didn't come for several years after right?
But
the
ones sporting. So you're saying sporting statues that honor.
I think they're in fashion now. Yeah.
Oh.
Statues at stadium.
Oh.
Stadia. Remember playing statue maker when you were a kid? Somebody would swing you around, and then however you landed,
you had to stay in that position.
There, and I don't remember the rest of the game.
I don't remember beyond that.
I do that with an app now.
You can play statue maker on an app?
Yeah, it's fun.
Bill, what would your statue depict?
I don't know.
An action figure in one hand?
Well, we know he asked us because he has an answer.
I don't think I'll ever get a... You guys are definitely going to get statues at some point. I don't think I'm going to get a statue.
Right, I didn't even question that. I just went, okay, well...
You just know. The only question on your statue, Wendy, is where it will be.
Yeah,
it has to be somewhere prominent.
In which alley?
All right, that is enough. I'm glad you both cracked yourselves up at my expense. I guess that's why I'm here.
I would have said by a Binnie's, but Steve went even darker.
I didn't mean it.
Good
I
for
didn't
you.
Mean that dark. I didn't mean it in the worst way. That was not my intent. But
I won't get a statue.
But what an honor that would be.
It's pretty great looking, too. And giant. I didn't believe how big it was.
Are they 12 feet tall each? Is that about right?
I don't know the dimensions. I just know seeing Jarrett and Brittany there, it was huge.
Yeah. Yep.
Really cool.
Wouldn't that be something... Also, when you think about to look at a statue of one of your parents, because you say to yourself, well, of course, I knew them and loved them, but now for generations, people can come upon these statues and understand the significance that that person had. That, what a high honor that would be.
Yeah, but listening to John Williams' show yesterday and just all the highlights of everybody dealing with Walter Payton, even if they didn't meet him physically, there were just these great moments. He had such an impact on everyone.
Would you put him in the category of people that even if you never knew or met, you feel like you did?
Yeah.
You know how there's certain people that you just, because they're part of your lives for so long, either through television or the radio or movies or just whatever,
yeah.
Music certainly, you just go, I never met the guy, but I feel like I know him. I never met Walter Payton, but in a weird kind of way, he was part of the sound that was football,
yeah,
when I was growing up.
You're,
you know?
Right.
But what a great honor that is.
It is a great honor. I didn't know that George Halas was supposed to be on the Eastland.
Yeah, that's how the story goes, that he was supposed to be and was running late or something, right? And didn't get on the boat.
I don't know the whole story, but yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
What a changed history. Right?
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm proud to be a Chicagoan, and I hate the Packers.
Oh, yep. Steve and I were talking before you came in. What if the Bears lose tomorrow night? Because tomorrow night is the start of the season. There's extra added pressure.
Totally.
It's your biggest rival, the Green Bay Packers. So what if they lose? I mean,
they may.
They easily may.
They're the favorite, though, correct?
I believe they are the favorite. Yeah. Which is nice, because we went a long time where that was not the story.
You're right.
The Bears were
Are you back on?
Almost often underdogs. I'm going to wait and see how things go tomorrow.
You're so fickle.
I need to see what happens tomorrow.
So are you guys, I was saying this in the newsroom, like opening day for baseball for me is huge.
Yes.
It, you know, because I think that has to do with the weather and the seasons.
Yes.
Opening day for the NFL, this doesn't quite have the same feel for
me. Even this year, Steve, with all the extra hoopla?
It's about the time of year, I think, you know? It's
because you dread the fact that the start of the football season means cold weather?
No, it's just not as exciting
to
them.
It's not something coming forward. Yeah, it just doesn't. I've got stuff outside to do.
Oh. That makes sense.
I mean it, you know?
You're not going to watch the game?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'll watch the game, but I'm not like, it's opening day, baby, you know?
Yeah.
I'm pretty excited about it, and I have friends who have season tickets, and if you go to the game, obviously it's more exciting.
Sure.
But to watch the first Bears football game on your television is pretty exciting to
me. Yeah, yeah. Is it weirder, though, that it's on a Thursday? Would you have preferred this first one to be on a Sunday, normal football viewing time? Yeah,
I like Sunday. I like the sound of a football game. It's easy to nap to.
Wow.
On a Sunday.
That's encouraging.
Not as good as bowling.
No,
that's
the best napping sport. All right, a break and then more show. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. I'm also going to say this about statues. And like I said, Wendy, you're going to get one. And Steve will probably get one. I'm not going to get one, but this is mostly for you. It would disturb me to no end knowing that birds were using my statue as a target constantly. I would want to, above my statue, I would want something
an
hovering.
An umbrella?
Yeah, like an umbrella. Yeah, that would be a great statue. Just hold an umbrella, you'd look like Mary Poppins.
You like to say bumper shoot a lot, so maybe that would be your statue holding an umbrella.
Yes.
You could be the new Morton Salt boy.
Here I go dreaming. Look at me. Did you see what's happening at St. Edward's School in Nashville?
I did see this in the news.
They are banning the Harry Potter books from the school's library.
Pretty Catholic school, isn't it?
The 7-book series, the Harry Potter book series, depicting the magical adventures of a young wizard and his friends, was removed from the library because their content, this according to Reverend Dan Rehill, the pastor at the Roman Catholic parish, said was inappropriate. These books present magic as both good and evil, which is not true, but in fact a clever deception. The curses and spells used in the Harry Potter books are actually curses and spells, which when read by a human, risk conjuring evil spirits into the presence of the person reading the text.
That's where we are in this country now. Anyone can buy a gun and anyone can buy a collar.
Yes, you're right. Now, am I to believe that if you read the words written in Harry Potter and those spells, that whatever the spell is will actually happen? That's what they're selling here?
No, but it's, their belief that would be worshiping a false idol, the Catholics have some strict ways about things. It's odd. Christians have decried Rowling's books, which promote the witchcraft, and that is anti-Christian. But J.K. Rowling is a Christian.
Yeah, well, and be careful, too. There are a gazillion Catholic parishes in this country, and I think this is the one that's banning
this is
them.
Right.
So
right,
I mean,
right,
it's
right.
not like it's
Oh, it's not all over the place.
Right.
But I do know Catholic people that would not allow their children to read these books.
Tell me how this makes sense. Before we had the house that we lived in an apartment, and the people who lived below us were extremely religious, not Catholic, but extremely, extremely religious. They had kids that wanted to see the Harry Potter movies, and no, you're not allowed to see the Harry Potter movies. You're not allowed to read the Harry Potter books. However, the Lord of the Rings books and movies were perfectly okay and welcome by that family.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I don't understand that because, in a way, I know I'm nitpicking here over the similarities and differences of those two storylines, but there's a lot that if one offends your belief system, I would think the other would also offend your belief system.
I agree with you on that. But I don't know. People make decisions that are right for them, and that's fine.
Yeah.
We grew up Catholic. My dad wasn't Catholic, but we had a Ouija board, and my mom wouldn't let us play with it. But then my question was, then why do we have it? I bet we still have it somewhere in the house.
Her argument, it was
it's
what
just
exactly?
Because you're calling upon spirits, and I'm like, well, they could be good spirits.
Are they friendly spirits? Just listen.
But that was a whole thing, too. It's
Was that from Bullwinkle? Why
yeah,
do I know?
I was like,
that's from Bullwinkle and Rocky.
Yeah,
Night.
It was in my head. It was yeah. spinning trying to figure that
I remember.
Out.
All right, so your mom's argument was this is conjuring up
spirits.
Evil spirits.
Yeah, evil spirits.
Evil spirits.
But not all spirits are evil. That was my argument back
right.
then.
Did you win that argument?
7-year-old Wendy.
No, you didn't win that argument?
I still played it.
Without her knowing?
Yeah.
It is strange that she allowed it into the house.
I know.
Very strange.
Don't go near the Ouija board.
But my brother and sister got to play with it. They're older than I am, so maybe she was trying to protect me.
But
didn't
right.
work.
So no. All right, so here's my question to the Reverend who has banned these books from the school in Nashville. Wouldn't you consider these works of fiction? Nobody has ever said that the Harry Potter books really happened
right.
or are happening. So couldn't you make the argument to him? It's literature, which is a very important part of any child's life, so they should be treated as such. They're in the fiction department, not in the nonfiction department.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So how...
I don't know. And can you read it out off school grounds?
Oh, that's a good question, too.
And if you're a parent that your kid goes to that school, somebody has texted, so Jesus can walk on water and turn water into wine, but fake magic is banned? I hope the lightning felt good, 630.
I wonder if I had kids attending that school, what I would do with that. You know, I would almost feel like I would need to have a discussion with him to try to figure out why. Because it doesn't make sense to me why. And it's not that I'm anti-religion. I understand
right.
the importance religion plays in most people's lives. I totally get that. But... These are books that are treated as fiction. They're, no one's saying this is the way life is. Evil spells, that's the way to go. No one's saying that.
Glenn has an interesting memory to share with us. Hi, Glenn. How are you?
I'm great, guys. Hey, when I was younger and I was in a Catholic school and the church had banned us from being able to listen to or go to the musical Jesus Christ Superstar because of the theme concept of wrapping the Bible into rock and roll.
Wow. Wow.
You know, that's
yeah.
interesting because that's one of my favorite musicals. My son played Judas in his high school version of it and felt guilty about being in it. He really did.
Oh, I enjoy, I mean, I'm one of those kind of people that when I hear the entire album, I sing it better than absolutely everybody
oh,
else that's in the album.
I'll sing with you. I'll have a sing-off. That is one of the best soundtracks. I love it.
Oh, it really was. But I enjoyed the fact that the assistant pastor of our church, who was not a big fan of doing our religion class, decided that one season, he decided, well, we're just going to listen to this album, because he was a very young priest, and that was going to be religion class. So, you know, So we go from one extreme to the absolute other. So, you know, that's the wonders of our lovely Catholic Church.
Thank you, Glenn. We appreciate it. Have a great day.
God spells okay, though?
I wonder. My mom used to tell us that before I was born and my brother was born, when she would go to church, in the missalette, in the thing that they would give you, there was a list of movies that they were banned by the Catholic Church.
Really?
And she said every week, you know, they would show the four or five new movies coming out that week, and the two or three that you could not see, that the church would decide, most times without even seeing them, the church would just hear what the story was about and just decide, no, we have to ban that. No one can see that. And she stuck to that list for years.
Yeah.
Because it was in the church program.
But they meant business. Commandments was okay? It seems like in a weird way that anything depicting your own version of what happened should not be okay.
Right. Right.
I'm wearing a cross today.
Yes, you are.
Will it make the statue?
Maybe.
Probably not.
Maybe.
We need to take a quick break, and then we have got an action-packed show today. There's an exhibit, a gallery show at the Hilton, and I don't know how to say the other part of the Hilton
Hotel.
Okay. This photojournalist has captured some no, ASMUS, the Hilton Osmus. Yeah. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Why don't you say it then? Why do you leave everything to me?
It's on my band word list.
One of the Osmus singers.
All right, well, we'll figure that out, but he's got this amazing new gallery show depicting all these important pictures in life and celebrities. It's really cool. Dr. John Duffy will be on with us after 11, and we have another guest, too, coming up at 11:35.
Jimmy Corrine.
Well, he's been on before.
Our friend.
I enjoy him.
He's been on before,
him. Yeah. All right, it's all coming up. It's Bill, it's Wendy, it's 720 WGN. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and we have a special guest in studio, Julian Wasser, a world-renowned photojournalist, started his days, what, is it really true, as a copy boy at the Washington Bureau of Associated Press?
Yes, that's right.
And now you are going to be at the Hilton Osmus Contemporary Gallery, 716 North Wells Street. Friday night is the opening night, and you will be showing your amazing photojournalistic pictures. You are quite a talent, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Covering a lot of old-time Hollywood. I was telling you off the air, it's like what's old is new again. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, and our love for old-time Hollywood is going to be shown in some of these photos. What are some of your iconic photos that you will be featuring in the world of Hollywood?
In the show,
yes.
At Hilton? Well, Steve McQueen,
he
Jack Nicholson,
gorgeous.
Martin Luther King.
And, all right, so there's a picture of Hugh Hefner. What's he doing in that picture?
Hugh Hefner's roller skating with two playmates.
And another, of course he is.
He really had a way with women.
So were you there? Did you get? You just were there to take the photos?
I was working for him, actually.
You were?
Yes.
That's pretty amazing.
He's a very good employer. A nice guy.
Julian, Wendy mentioned Once Upon a Time in America. Your career kind of interweaves with that storyline quite a bit.
With the old time.
You had some contact with Roman Polanski.
Yeah, Roman Polanski hired me to go to the house, the murder house, 3 days after the murder of Sharon Tate, to do Polaroid photographs to get psychic vibration to try to figure out who the murderers were, because to that time, nobody knew who they were. It was an ABC TV crew that actually sort of solved the thing.
That's amazing.
And I went with Roman and photographed him looking through all Sharon's belongings. It was really, I felt like a grave robber.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
But it's an assignment you don't want to turn down. It was certainly
it's the biggest
story in America
at
the time.
Absolutely. No, you've got to do that. You can't turn that down.
Yeah. You've seen the film. You've seen Once Upon a Time in America. What's your impression of that story?
Well, it sort of glossed over all the bad things.
Yeah.
And they made the Spahn Ranch look idyllic and nice, and it actually wasn't. It was a horrible place.
Yeah, yeah. What is your goal when you take a picture, Julian, any picture, what is your goal in that picture?
Well, to put everybody that looks at it in my place, to be right there, to evoke a real feeling of what was happening.
It is difficult to capture, like we just had our headshots taken, and they did a very good job, but it's really hard to capture
someone. We want you to
someone.
Take our headshots, yes, is what we do.
No, but it's hard to capture someone's personality in just a staged photo, isn't
make
it?
Make them look good, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a miracle working, right?
Yeah.
That's what you hire.
Right. Right. Is it better to take somebody's picture when they're not expecting it?
No, that's
it's
the
not.
Worst.
Really?
God knows what they'll look like.
Explain this to me. So much of your work, your iconic work, is in black and white as opposed to color. Why that choice? And tell me what your thought process is on the difference between a black and white photograph and a color photograph.
Well, first of all, for some reason, collectors and aficionados of photography seem to like black and white better. That's the stuff they buy. For some reason, color is suspect than I don't know why. It's not realistic to them, but actually we see in color, so that's what realism is.
Yeah. I've heard people describe, this is with films anyway, with movies, not so much pictures, but a black and white film is more of a dreamlike state. You're looking at it as a dream almost, as opposed to a reality. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't.
No, you don't? No.
Because they didn't want to spend money for color. It's the producer's fault.
Sometimes a black and white photo looks more artsy to me.
Yeah.
It just depends.
I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't really either. Tell us about you were at the Ambassador Hotel in 1968, and Robert F. Kennedy was there. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, it was chaos. I was at the Ambassador Hotel. Bobby Kennedy was giving his victory speech. And I was on the photo platform in front shooting for time. And then he went back in the kitchen and Sirhan shot him. And I was at that whole death watch. He lived on for about 24 hours and died. It was just chaos.
And see, I don't know how that would make me feel. In a way, it's like, oh, you're so
very
thankful
upsetting.
That
very
you
upsetting.
Got the photo.
Chaos, yeah. Because I mean, the guy was everybody's hero. And all of a sudden, he's shot down and erased. It's horrible.
Yeah.
That's how fragile life is.
You've shot covers for Time Magazine, Newsweek, People. You've appeared in Vanity Fair, Playboy, Elle, Vogue, GQ. Who are some of your favorite subjects that you photographed?
Well, the shot I did of Steve McQueen at Paramount on the set of Love with a Proper Stranger, very successful photo. I judge my photos by their success. If people like it, I like it.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that. The Beatles?
That was something. Yeah, I shot that in Soho. They did a press conference after they got the OBE from the Queen. They came into town to Soho and they did a press conference. And I was in town at the time, so I shot that. I don't know if that ever ran in Time. I don't know who used that.
Beach Boys.
I was on the road with them.
Oh, my God.
Nice, nice guys.
Really?
Great guys.
Is there a process, Julian, where you feel like you need to make the subject of your photograph comfortable with you? Is that part of the...
Well, you have to do that if you want to get a picture. I mean, actors, TV and film, they hate stills because it commits them forever. So if you get a bad photographer, they can be crucified.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you can reassure them, make them think you're on their side and you're glad they're making all that money, they're very cooperative.
Yeah.
Is there someone that was very difficult to photograph?
Yeah, Charles Bronson, the worst.
Was he? Why?
Wouldn't let his guard down, maybe.
Because he's a working class guy, and he was not, I guess he hated Time, and he's not going to make my life easy. He did everything he could to mess me up, but I outlasted him. I'm still alive, too.
When you see those pictures that you took of Charles Bronson, even though he's being difficult, are you happy with the way they turned out?
Oh, yeah.
You
right.
are? Good.
All you got to do is get the photo, make the client happy, and you won.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you very critical of your own work
yes,
when you're
I
going
am.
Through
yes.
proofs? I mean,
yes.
Now everything's digital. Do you have an iPhone? Do you take pictures on your iPhone? Can you give us tips?
I hate the iPhone. I got a Leica instead, much better than an iPhone.
You have what?
A Leica CL. That's what you want to get. You take real pictures with it. All you need is money to buy it.
All right. Well, you can just give me your hand-me-downs when you get a new one.
Do you think, Julian, to some extent, our appreciation of the art of photography has changed because it's almost become too accessible? Everybody always has their phone out and they're snapping pictures, but not really concerned with the quality. Has that changed things?
Well, they never were concerned with the quality, but it's always this selfie mentality. Look, here I am, and they love that.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad, isn't it, that there's not more time and effort to put into the photographs?
Well, what's too bad is that no one is reading newspapers or magazines anymore.
Yeah.
That's what's too bad.
Yes.
I love to hold a newspaper.
Yeah,
I love to hold a magazine.
You want to feel it.
Yes. It's so different. I mean, we do see it online because it's quicker.
But I have no retention of online stuff.
Yeah.
And I forget it.
Yeah. Frank Zappa. Tell me a Frank Zappa story.
Frank Zappa was going to sue me because one of my pictures of him was used on a school book, and he hated schools. Very nice guy. Too bad he died so young.
Is the mindset different when you're photographing a movie star as opposed to a musician, as opposed to a politician? Is there a different game going on in the room?
A movie star is the top of the heap. You better be careful, or they'll throw you out. I've been kicked off many sets.
Have you really?
Yes,
who kicked you off of a set?
Doris Day, Raquel Welch.
Now, Doris Day is known as one of the gentlest, kindest women in show business. What happened between you and Doris Day?
I think she said, I think you have enough. And I said, no, I want a few more. And I was in the men's room when the publicist in the 20th came in and they said, you got to leave the lot immediately.
I like that your squabbles have been with Doris Day and Charles Bronson. That's amazing to me.
Also Raquel Welch.
And Raquel Welch, what
she
happened
told
there?
Bob Hope, get him off the set. And he came up, he was really apologetic. He said, look, it's either you or her, so it's going to be you.
Wow. Wow.
John Travolta. Talk to us about John Travolta.
I photographed him on a rehearsal studio in Doheny Drive. When he got that job for Saturday Night Fever, he didn't even know how to dance. And he had Denny Terrio.
Oh, Dance Fever host.
Yeah, teaching him how to dance.
And you took photos of that.
Yeah, right. It was great.
Julian Wasser is here. He's got a photo exhibit at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery in Chicago opening September the 6th.
This Friday.
It's called The Way We Were. Incredible photographs. We'll take a break and talk to Julian more next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right. We are chatting with Julian Wasser. He is a photojournalist. Now, you mentioned some of your subjects, Martin Luther King. What do you remember and what event did you...
I remember I went to the speech he gave in L.A. I didn't realize how immensely popular the man was. I went to what's called Wrigley Field in L.A. It's where the Angels were. I think they've torn it down since then. But he was there and there were at least 30,000 people there. It was amazing. And they just worshiped this man. He was really something. I never realized how big he was before that.
All right. The Watts riots, also in L.A.
The Watts riots. That was the last time you could go down to Watts and just cruise around. I think I got a brick through my windshield. I would be in lines of cars and pickups loaded with TV sets and refrigerators or something. I was the only white guy there in this line of looters. But, you know, they wanted the refrigerators and TV, not me.
Yeah, that's true. So, obviously, some of these things were scary. Some of them were
Absolutely. Exhilarating.
Are there some subjects that you regret not having photographed?
Well,
is there someone you really...
Kennedy's funeral in D.C. I was stuck in L.A. then. And in Dallas when the shooting happened, that would have been something. All these big world events.
Julian, explain this. There's a phrase you hear about certain people in photographs where let's say the camera loves ... Explain that. How does the camera love certain people but not love other people?
Well, some people you just can't get a decent picture of. Others you can't get a bad picture of. It's great.
Isn't that something? That somebody would have that quality.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah. For them and me.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
The photographer at my wedding told me, you know how in the old days people would go, say cheese. He told me to say the word yes, because that kind of like lightened up your eyes. You being an iconic photographer, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm dealing with people you can't tell what to do or say.
Yeah.
You do what they want to do. You're there at their disposal.
What's a good word to say to get a natural smile?
I can't say it on air.
No.
What does it start? Does it start with an S?
Yes, with an S, right.
That's what my grandmother always said when you take a picture of my grandmother.
Grandmother knew.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, you'll have to go see Julian Wasser. He is going to be at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery. It's 716 North Well Street right here in Chicago. Opening night is Friday. You will be there, and then this exhibit runs through October.
And it's really worth looking at the pictures. I mean, the food will be good, but look at the pictures. They're better.
Oh, they tell such a story. You mentioned Steve McQueen smoking a smoke. That's right. One of your pictures. Hugh Hefner roller skating with some bikini clad friends.
Which you'd want Hugh Hefner to be doing. That's what makes sense for Hugh Hefner.
That's what makes Hugh Hefner, right.
When you see these photographs years later, Julian, is it a time machine for you? Do you get yourself
Absolutely.
Back? Yeah.
And actually, the show at the Hilton Gallery is amazing. They've made my pictures look 10 times better. I don't know how they did
it. How did they do this?
Well, they made them real big. Oh. And they're placed right.
Yeah.
I mean, and they really did the right thing. I'm glad they did it.
Did you have a say in which photographs were used?
No, they
did not.
It was their taste.
Interesting.
There are featured portraits of David Bowie in a lovely dress, I understand.
Did you have to convince him, or did he just say, I have an idea?
No, he showed up in that dress.
He did.
That was him, the real him, genuine Bowie.
Yeah.
Sonny and Cher,
right.
Clowning for the camera. There's some a cool picture of the Beatles, the Jackson 5. Jane Mansfield dancing her butt off at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Right.
You captured that?
Well, in those days, every time you went to a club or a supermarket, there were superstars. There's not like today where they have shoppers and this and that, and they're never anywhere. They're home hiding or on the lot. They were available then.
Farrah Fawcett checking her makeup on the set of Charlie's Angels. Yes. What was she like? Was she nice to you?
Oh, it was a dream to be in the presence of this beautiful woman.
Would that be one of those people that the camera just adored her?
Absolutely.
She'd fit into that category.
Yeah, she was something.
Yeah. Yep.
Jack Nicholson and Angelica Houston clowning around.
Yes, in his house. That was for Der Stern in Germany. And that ran as a cover in my alumni magazine. And someone was outraged that she's in a bikini. They thought it was her underpants, but it was actually a bikini she bought in Saint-Tropez. So it was very stylish. You got to forgive her.
And what's the photograph of the nude chess player? Right. I don't know anything about this. Is there someone playing chess in the
Marcel
nude?
Marcel Duchamp, the father of pop art, who in 1911 did Nude Descending a Staircase. He's playing chess with a naked Eve Babbitt that everyone in L.A. wanted to see naked, so he's quite happy.
Checkmate.
Right.
And Andy Warhol, what can you tell us about him? You photographed him.
I got a picture of him smiling. That was a first.
All right,
that's unusual.
No wonder you get the iconic photographer, because, I didn't see him smile too frequently.
He wasn't much to smile, but you got him.
Look what happened to him.
I know. Good point.
It is such a pleasure to meet you. Really, I just feel more connected and closer to all these events by looking at your picture. You also have a book out that's available on Amazon. What's that called?
The Way We Were.
Perfect. It is such a pleasure to meet you again. You can go to the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery, 716 North Wells. Friday night is the opening night. Julian Wasser will be there, and then that exhibit runs through October. You can also go to his website, Julian Wasser, WASSER.com. It's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Yeah, well, I hope you'll be there Friday.
I would love to be there.
Good.
There'll be naked chess, Wendy.
I'll play naked chess.
All right. Now we're talking.
Hey, thank you
Julian
so much.
Looks scared now.
I know.
What
See,
happened?
You asked me off the air if I was going to scare you. I think I did.
Waited till the end.
Are we live?
Yes, we're still going. Yeah. We're going to wrap up, though. Thank you so very much, and tell me that word to say to get a good smile out of my face.
Not
we'll
yet,
do that
not
off
yet.
The air.
Not yet.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here. It's WGN. Dr. John Duffy is with us once again, clinical psychologist, best-selling author of The Available Parent, and the new book, Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety, is available for pre-order now. I always get confused as to when it's coming out. John, when's it coming out for sure? It
comes out for sure September 15th, without question. Amazon has promised me himself.
Yeah. Oh.
Mr. Amazon?
Joey Amazon?
Quite a guy, that Joey.
Yeah,
he's really
knew
got
he
an
was
empire.
Italian.
Yeah.
But it is available for pre-order now. I've been reading through it. I'm not going in order. Is that okay?
It is recommended. intended. Go where you, the
where
juice
I
is.
Need it.
Yep. That's why there is a table of contents.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
And there are some great things. I want to bring something up specifically about, you know, technology and, you know, in your house, you guys don't have TVs in your bedroom.
Right.
So does that make me a bad parent that we have TVs in our bedroom?
No, not necessarily. You know, here's the thing. You know, I try in here to provide guidelines for keeping a lot of communication open. Does that mean you have to do it exactly the way I did or exactly the way the family across the street did? No, every family has a culture. And if you find a culture that works in your home, listen, a lot of separation mm-hmm. is important in families.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's important to be together a lot. It's also important to be apart and for your kids to manage a lot of their time on their own. So sometimes right. having the challenges of, okay, I got a TV in my room, I got a computer, I got a phone, I got homework to do. I want to binge watch this thing. I want to watch these YouTube videos. Now I've got to manage all this stuff. That's
a lot.
It's a lot, but you know, it's really good for kids to be able to do that. It's a really good set of skills for them to put together and manage. So that is not the end of the world. They're just managing a different set of challenges than some other kids might. You know what I mean? But it all serves a higher purpose of getting somewhere.
John, we have a TV production studio in our bedroom. Is that a bad thing?
I suspect the point of that is different than what we're talking
it
about.
Is. But it totally is. You're right.
That's weird.
Yeah, I guess.
Bottom line is we really try to be the best parents we can be. And it's why isn't it easy to be a parent? I thought, wow, this is just you say something, your kids listen. Everything's copacetic, but it's hard to be a parent.
I was giving a talk to parents recently, and this one dad said, it really feels like you're laying in hard on the parents. And I said, no, I think it's really hard to be a parent these days. And he said, I don't know. You're telling us we need to be more available and open, and you know, it seems like you're laying into the parents. And eventually I just asked him, what did you do? Did you do something awful that you need absolution from?
Yeah.
But the truth is, you're right, Wendy. It is really, really hard. And one thing that's changed over the course of a generation is that our parents, they had the keys. They had the keys to the relationship. In other words, if they wanted us to talk, we were probably going to talk, right?
Yeah.
Now, our kids have the keys. They decide the flow of communication. So we know, like, if our kids decide now, if a 15-year-old decides, I'm not talking to my parents, they can shut you out. They can ice you out.
Right.
And there's not much you can do about that other than shift what you do, shift the vibe that you bring to them. So mostly what I'm talking about to parents about isn't specific techniques or whether there's a TV in the bedroom. It's kind of like, do you create this vibe in your house that feels like a sanctuary? You know, like kids right now, you guys can probably feel it. They're super anxious. School's just starting. So there's a lot of juice. There's a lot of energy buzzing around. And those 7 hours a day are a little anxiety provoking. So if home can feel calm for them and feel like, okay, mom and dad have got my back and, you know, I can take a little break and have a cookie and, you know, and then I can get to studying or whatever it is I need to do. That means the world to them. You know what I mean? That centers them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not centered most of the day. They're still trying to figure out, like, what's my locker combination? You know, like, and, you know, where's my history class again? You know, so the more we can bring them some calm and some comfort, they've got plenty of challenges out there. We don't need to add more.
Can you do me a favor? Rewind a little bit to the holding of the keys where you said it used to be it was the parents and now it's the kids.
Yes.
What changed? Why did that change?
I think it's the onset of like social media, having a lot of information at their fingertips and recognizing, oh, we have a lot more power and agency and information than kids used to. They don't necessarily think that thought, but they know that they know a lot.
Yeah, right.
And so when they're told to do something, they have this thought in their mind that we might not have had at young ages, like, well, I'd like to know why.
Right.
Why does the garbage have to be taken out now?
Right.
Or, you know, like, why do I have to talk to you right now? I'm busy or I'm frustrated and I think this is just going to escalate. So I'm going to go up to my room until I feel calmer, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas I think we were parented out of either a sense of obligation to our parents or a sense of fear or something like that. And kids today, and I think this is the better story, they're not afraid of us.
Right.
And I kind of like that. So we need to create a more collegial atmosphere. In order to gain a grasp on the keys a little bit, yeah, we need to have a kind of collaborative, collegial, likable atmosphere, you know, friendly atmosphere in our homes. And then I think we have a little more agency to get in there and get to learn their worlds a little bit more.
Yeah.
There are still parents out there, though, who want to hold the key and who criticize other parents for wanting to have a conversation with their kids. We don't have to be their best friend. We're not going to be.
No.
You know, the I hate you or you're stupid. Yeah, I know. That's my job.
Right.
But that is our job, but we can still, I just feel like sometimes if you rule with an iron fist, you're not going to get anything back.
I think that's right. I think, and that is really tough, because, and I get why a lot of us feel like, well, that worked for me, and I'm perfectly fine now. Things have changed rather rapidly in kids' worlds, you know, and I think the smartphone is a big part of that. And I think, you know, there's a lot of more academic and social pressures that they're suffering, and so they hold a little more tightly to their own power when they're home. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because they don't always feel powerful outside of the home.
Right.
So ruling with an iron fist just adds more stress to their world. And whereas we might have capitulated to anything our parents said in that regard, now kids are going to walk away. And I've seen that quite literally. I've seen kids get up and walk out of the therapy room if they were told, you are going to treat me this way. You are not going to disrespect me. Some kids are like, this isn't going anywhere. Yeah, I'm out of here.
Can you address this text? It's called Respect. We actually respected our parents, where kids nowadays have no respect.
Yeah. So I understand that thought completely to the texter, because it really looks that way a lot of the time. Here's the reality. Kids, if you get them alone and you get them talking about their parents, about their teachers, they actually have a lot of respect for the adults around them. The discourse, the language is sometimes very different. Sometimes that's on us, too. Sometimes we are modeling, you know, in our household, swearing was okay, you know, when George was growing up. And so I couldn't really lay into him really hard when he started swearing at 16 years old, you know. So we have a little bit of a different culture now that doesn't
John,
mean it's free of respect.
It still throws you, doesn't it? When you hear your own children swear, there's part of you that just goes, wait, what did you just say, right?
Especially early on.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And the hard part, I think, as a side note for parents in that regard, is not just to laugh, because it sounds funny to hear 11, 12, 13-year-olds swear.
Yeah.
You know, there's a movie with a bunch of boys who are swearing constantly.
Yeah.
And I've heard that's the funny part of the movie is, you know, like how irreverent these kids are.
Right, sure.
Right. Yeah. But I get the texter's point. I just don't think that respect is missing as much as it would appear to be.
And all I can say is I fought with my mom a lot. I, in a way, I'm glad I didn't have a girl, because I was probably not easy for my mom.
Right.
And I had a smart mouth. But you spend your whole life trying to please your parents.
Right.
So, I mean, respect is shown in different ways now, I believe. And I wasn't very open. I didn't swear at my mom. But if I was a kid today, and I might have.
Right, you might have. But that wouldn't necessarily mean you respect her any less.
Right.
And I think that idea that we want our goodwill from our parents, we want them to think highly of us, every kid I've ever known, and there's hundreds of them, all feel that way. I mean, part of the anxiety of the day is, I don't think I'm living up to my parents' expectations, whether they say that or not.
Mm. John Duffy's here. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute or two. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and it's WGN.
Bill, you cracked me up.
Yeah, it happens sometimes. Dr. John Duffy's here. He's already got one best-selling book, The Available Parent, but another one is on the way. On September the 15th, you can get Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety. It's up for pre-order right now on Amazon. You wanted to talk about, I didn't see this coming, John. I thought I knew you.
Right.
But you wanted to talk about what you just saw on an episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
So I'm a big fan of that show. I get a big kick out of like, you know, Seinfeld's fascination with comedians. And every once in a while, there's a guy I'm not, or a woman I'm not very familiar with. And Brian Regan is one of them.
Hysterically funny.
I was going to say, I knew you
so
guys.
So funny.
Yes. And he said the following. He said, in this kind of pithy final moment, I always say that the things you remember in life are the things that happen right after you have butterflies, those butterflies in your stomach. So you should never avoid the butterflies because those are the memory makers. Which my wife and I, Julie, we were both just so struck by as such a lovely sentiment.
He's
and
right.
A really good cue, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, so we psychologists spend a lot of our time talking about anxiety is it's a symptom that needs to be controlled with better medication and therapy. And yet here on the counterpoint is, but some anxiety is a good thing and is a cue that, you know, like, I'm drawn to this. I want to do this. I want to try this. Wendy, you were talking about dating a minute ago.
When you think back of the first time you had a date with someone you're with now, it was nerve-wracking. You're like, oh, I hope I don't say something stupid. Oh, I'm going to see him tonight. Those butterflies are there. And the butterflies continue, but not as intense or as frequently as
right.
that first time you started dating.
Right, right, right.
And
exactly.
good things come after it, sometimes bad. But
right, but it's something to... it's an experience you want, you know, and these comedians talk a lot about how even after 40 years of doing this, I still, every time I walk out there, I have butterflies and I long for that feeling. I live for that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to demarcate the difference between anxiety that doesn't work for you and is your body telling you no. This is not something that you want to be heading toward, and to listen to that, but to also recognize, oh, this is excitement and anxiety, and that combination, I probably ought to move in that direction. This is probably what I'm most drawn to in life, even if it makes me nervous.
So how do you find a balance of the healthiest amount of this for yourself? I'm guessing everybody's quotient is different, right?
Yeah,
it's got to be.
I think so. But I think sometimes we err on the conservative side and assume if I feel nervous at all, I don't want to do the thing.
Yeah, right.
And so my press is usually like, let's go on the let's spin this 180 degrees. Let's talk about what it would be like if you did try the thing, if you went toward the thing, if you joined the team, if you got in front of the microphone, if you got in the classroom or did the job interview, maybe that's what you want, and you're just nervous to get there or afraid of being rejected or something like that.
Right.
We can work with that. We can overcome some of that stuff. And so I think the quotient's different for everybody, but I think most of us in this day where even I will cop to using the word anxiety far too often. So it feels like this bad, awful thing, right? This foreboding thing. But the truth is, it's not always bad. It's motivating. And sometimes it's telling us that's what you want to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And think about in life, many times we've come to a crossroads. We could do this or we could do that. And I have told my kids to give it a try, because if you try and you don't succeed, at least you can check that off your list. If you never tried it, then it's like you spend a lot of maybe the rest of your life wondering, what if I did that?
Right, right, right. Exactly. And to both your points, to your point in particular, Bill, like that idea of trying something. So sometimes we get anxious, we catastrophize the result. This is going to be awful if it doesn't go well. But by and large, if we try things, even if they don't go beautifully, nothing catastrophic happens. I think that's an important thing to teach ourselves, is like, you know, sometimes our bodies will lie to us by degree.
Right.
And anxiety sometimes will do that. So to calibrate that, you sometimes have to step off the ledge a little
bit. Yeah, sure.
You know? Yeah.
You know what I like doing? When I go to an amusement park and I'm next in line to get on a roller coaster, I like looking at the faces of everybody as their roller coaster is about to take off, because you see such a stretch of emotions. Most of the people are very excited and can't wait, and they've been looking forward to this all day. But there's so many people that are just sitting there scared, maybe praying, just nervous. And you say, you know that this has made this route thousands and thousands of times. You're going to come back safely. But it's just fun to watch the differences in emotion from people about to go on a roller coaster ride.
Definitely. And to that point, I read a thing recently about the back end of that. So as the roller coaster comes in, the anxiety quotient is way down.
Yeah.
And even people who are real anxious going on that ride the first time are game for going on it again.
Sure.
You know, and maybe even upping the ante. Like, I'll do that thing with the free fall. Yes.
Right? right? We got through it and we won.
Yeah, so that was more fun than I thought, and I'm glad I overcame the anxiety and did the thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Once is enough. I would never keep going. And there's somebody, I don't know who to attribute this quote to, because I read a lot and I listen to you a lot and I see things, but if you're going to try something new, you say, what's the worst thing that could happen? Will I die?
Right.
Because chances are you're not going to die from doing it. So if it goes badly, you know, you go, oh, well, chalk it off to experience.
When I'm working with people who are anxious, that's usually my metric. You know,
Maybe you're the one who told me that.
Will it kill you? If it's not going to kill you, we can probably give it a try.
John, do me a favor. A texter says, can John please repeat the butterfly quote? Now, this came the other day from an episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Brian Regan. Very funny guy. What did he say exactly?
So he exactly said, I always say that the things you remember in life are the things that happen right after you have butterflies. So you should never avoid the butterflies because those are the memory makers.
That's so profound.
Isn't it? Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's true. The things that we most remember, we were a little nervous about going in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty brilliant.
You know, in along those same lines, I realized this as a kid, the stuff that made you nervous at some point that you dreaded and you didn't know what was, if you go like a month in advance and look back at that, you go, I can't believe that that made me nervous.
Right.
That thing that I was so stressed out about for days or weeks or months, and it just kind of came and went.
Right. It's almost like you kind of build your scaffolding of resilience, right?
Yeah.
So you start at the bottom and you're like, okay, I did the first thing and I feel pretty good about that. I think I can go up another floor.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that's how we become more and more competent, resilient as we go.
You should write a book.
Should I?
Yeah, you should definitely write a book, and you should have it out on September 15th.
I'll write it quickly.
All right.
Also, if you're in the LaGrange area, you will be speaking at Lyons Township High School.
I will.
And that's coming up in September as well?
September 19th, I believe. Yes.
You got butterflies, John?
I will. I will absolutely have butterflies, which means that's the thing I'm going to
do. Does it make you nervous to do stuff like that?
Absolutely.
Does it?
Sure.
Interesting.
Sure. So for those of you who are there, watch me 15 seconds before I get started. You'll see it.
I see. You don't get that at all for anything anymore.
I can't remember the last time something like that made me nervous.
The last time I felt nerves, I was introducing Donovan. I got to introduce him as he came out and played at the Paramount Arts Theater.
Well, yeah.
And I was super nervous. Uh-huh. And I was prepared. I like to wing things a lot, but something that I'm not 100% familiar with, I want to have something at least written down. I totally get the jitters. You don't get it for anything.
I can't remember the last time
you
I did.
You need to be alive, Bill.
Or you could go line up on the scaffolding. Like,
no,
maybe there's something up there.
I can't do that. No, I know what my limits are.
You found your zone.
I did. John, thank you so much.
Thanks,
thank you, guys.
That's Dr. John Duffy. We'll take a quick break and then back with more show. Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Thank you, Ryan. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And we are going to find out. We've like figured out what to do. You can go see Julian Wasser, who we had on earlier.
Right.
And now you can go to a place called Hey Nani and enjoy some pretty wonderful food and then see some pretty talented people. So I don't know which order to introduce people in.
I always go alphabetically, Wendy.
All right, we said Hey Nani. That's the name of a restaurant, bar, and fun place in Arlington Heights. Chip Brooks is here. Hi, Chip.
Hey there. How you guys doing?
We're doing great. And then you have something going on at your restaurant, First Person Live. We have Diane Castile, producer, director, and host of that. So hi, Diane.
Hi.
And then we have Jimmy Corain, who is a friend of Bill's. No.
That's true.
Comedian.
That's true. Full disclosure.
Improviser. You have your podcast, Improv Nerd. And how do you guys all come together? Somebody needs to begin this.
I'll start. This is Chip. And we started Hey Nani. It's a music venue and farm-to-table restaurant in downtown Arlington Heights. And it opened a little less than a year ago. And we've been doing all different kinds of music and types of entertainment in our music venue room. And we try to just experiment with new things. And Diane has been producing this first-person live storytelling show, which is like The Moth. She's been producing that for several years. And so starting next week, she's going to be producing that show in Arlington Heights. And Jimmy's going to be performing.
Yeah, and I met Diane because she curates this wonderful storytelling night. And so she's you live in Arlington Heights, and she drives I don't know how many miles, but she ended up Millions. In Evanston one night, and I was doing an open night, and she's like, "You got to do my show." And I'm like, "Arlington Heights, you know, I'm an Evanston guy, you know, that's a whole day trip.
It is pretty far."
And, so that's how we met, and this is the second time I'm doing it, and it's just so
excellent.
Fun. Yeah,
this has become all the rage, Diane, as you know, the storytelling. Why has this taken off so much in the last several months or years?
It's really been years, and I think, well, there's a lot of reasons, but I think, and I think most people feel, it's a kind of a reaction to, people are craving personal connection.
Yes.
Kind of relax, not to throw shade on social media,
right.
But there's a little bit of, you know, a lot of digital stuff and not a lot of live stuff and personal connection, and so people just crave, you know, we don't put our shows on line. You want to see the show, you want to hear the stories, come there live.
Be there live.
And I think, and it also people are telling true stories from their lives and, you know, letting the guard down and just being honest and authentic. And I think people are craving that too.
What are the guidelines for anybody participating in this?
Well, it is a curated show, as Jimmy said.
Yeah.
It's open to anybody, but you do have to submit a story. Guidelines, submission form, all that is on the website. But it's the key about this type of storytelling, personal narrative storytelling, is it's regular people. It's not professional performers.
Right.
So anybody who's lived a life and has a story and wants to submit is welcome.
You mentioned the connecting, and that is so true. If you're not familiar with The Moth, it's just... It's live stories of people talking. There are also TED Talks that people do these things too. And you want to hear someone else mention something that you may be experiencing because it kind of makes you feel better, doesn't it?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I think that's the connection. You want to know you're not experiencing this thing by yourself. There are other people that have the same thing going on.
Absolutely, and that's a good point. A lot of the stories are, you know, funny and light. People are out for a night of entertainment, but I make a point to include stories that are more serious, sometimes poignant, sometimes, you know, a little dark or challenging for that very reason. It tells people, whatever you're going through, you're not alone. We're all struggling.
So how do you pace a show when you're putting together several storytellers? Do you want to vary it, a sad story, funny story, scary story? How do you put that together in your head?
It really depends on the story. Every show is different, and there is a mix, and it depends on the individual mix of the story. So it's not like funny, sad, scary, because if the funny and sad stories are both about, I don't know, something that happened on vacation, I might separate those because you don't want two vacation stories.
Yeah, right,
so
it's
kind of a eclectic mess.
So you've heard the stories prior to all of them being performed.
Yeah, right? They've either been submitted through our website, so I've read them, or I've actually seen the person perform, in the case of Jimmy.
Like Jimmy.
I also know the storytelling community in Chicago really, really well. I've been performing at The Moth for going on 10 years now, so
Jeez.
I know who's got what stories, so I recruit that way as well.
And Jimmy, what story will you be doing?
I will be telling a story about when my dad died and at his funeral, and my family didn't want me to speak at the funeral, and it was out in Winnetka. It was a church out in Winnetka, and the police had to come in or were about to come in to prevent me from speaking at the church, and I persevered, and it got kind of violent because somebody pushed me from behind the pew. I actually had to stand up in the pew and say, "I'm going to speak at my dad's funeral," and then somebody comes up from behind and pushes me, and I end up going in speaking and saying my dad's eulogy. And just my dad, before he died, he wanted me to speak because I'm in the business,
yes.
You know, Bill. You know,
yes.
And he said, "I would like you to speak at my funeral and make everybody laugh." And that wasn't the end result, but I did get to speak at my dad's funeral, so I'll be telling that story.
And I remember when you were up with us last time, you were speaking about this, and I had never met you before. And when you walked out of here, I felt like I knew you so completely.
Right, and that I think to me is the test of a good storyteller.
Yeah,
you want to leave and go, "Oh my God, that guy just just threw all his guts out.
Yes.
Or that guy has crazy thoughts, or that woman has crazy thoughts, whatever it is. I want to get to know the person when I leave.
Conversely, Jimmy, I've known you for years, and when you left, I felt like I had never met you.
Bill, that was intentional. We were very competitive back in the day.
Yeah, I know.
That's Jimmy Corain. He will be participating in this First Person Live. And also Diane Castile is here. And Chip Brooks from... it's a musical venue, farm to table. I didn't write all that down, but it's called Hey Nani.
Yep, it's called
Which is Shakespearean.
Which is Shakespearean.
You knew that, didn't you? Because I asked off the air, well, and Arlington I felt Heights, stupid. You were giving me a look.
Everybody knows.
Every venue in Arlington Heights, it's all Shakespearean references.
It's a Shakespeare festival, pretty much 365 days a year in Arlington Heights.
Yes, it is.
You can't get the court jesters off the street. You know, it's like.
And if you go there, Bill, you have to order in pentameter? What is
pentameter.
The, yes,
you iambic pentameter.
You have to order like this, right?
Yeah, iambic pentameter. That's all we speak in, pretty much.
I would like the chicken wings of...
And that's one of the things.
Right.
No, we'll get that together on the next break. But yeah, we started, like I said,
about a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And our goal was to create a great live music venue in the Northwest suburbs because we didn't have one. My business partner and I, Chris Dungan, we felt like we were driving a long way to Chicago or Evanston to go to cool places.
Right.
And we thought, man, we should build one in Arlington Heights where we live. So we did.
And that's First genius. Person Live is actually a perfect fit for the venue, isn't it?
It's going to be great.
Yeah.
It's going to be something quite different than what we usually do because, as I say, normally we have musical acts in there, and this will be a storytelling event. But it's going to fit the room fantastic, and people are going to love it. And as a matter of fact, our first show is sold out already because people are so much looking
sold
forward
out two
to
weeks
it.
Early.
That's awesome.
That's wonderful news.
There will be a second night, right?
Well, it's going to be every month, and the next show will go on sale tomorrow morning for October 15th. And the title of that show is Scary, 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 if I remember correctly. So people can buy tickets at the Hey Nani website. It's heynani.com. And it also so happens that all our shows are up for sale on that website, too.
Oh, nice. Very, very nice. So with this, we talked about pacing a show earlier. With the scary stories, it's going to be one after another, right? You're going to build it all on horror-filled stories.
Well, things that scare us.
Yeah.
And so for adults, what's scary is a little different than, you know, what's scary for kids, but we're playing off on the Halloween theme.
So yeah. Jimmy's showing up a month early, though, because his story sounded pretty scary to me.
Well, I do everything scary.
Yeah.
I'm scared all the time. I'm scared right now.
And earlier, I said a lot of times we'll hear a story, and it's something we've experienced. I don't think anyone else has experienced your story.
No.
I think you're pretty original.
No, you know, it's funny you say that because I did my show, World's Greatest Dad, which I'm going to plug. I'm going to put it back up in November. And the two things people would come up to me and say, because in the story it was about my dad going to jail for white-collar crime. He stole millions and millions of dollars in real estate. And people would come up to me and say, you know, my dad did something like that too, but he never got caught.
Wow.
Which I thought was great. And then other people would come to me about the funeral story and say, you know what? I had the same experience, and I don't want to – I'm Catholic, even though everyone thinks I'm Jewish. You can't tell on the air. But people would say to me, I had the same experience – at a Catholic church with the priest saying you only have 3 minutes because that's part of the story. They said you could speak, but you only have three minutes.
Wow.
So that's the kind of stuff when you come and see a storytelling show, yet you feel really great about it because people, you think, just like you said, only person that had an experience like I did, but really there's a lot of people who do have the same experience.
Well, and it doesn't have to be the exact same experience.
Right.
It can just be maybe you didn't have that experience in your family, but I'm guessing you got a crazy family story.
Right. Maybe your dad didn't go to jail for 33 months.
No, he
maybe
didn't.
He just got, you know, maybe he just got community service.
But my Aunt Phoebe, he didn't. At my Aunt Phoebe, at her husband Alvaro's funeral, did not want to let him go, so she pulled him out of the casket. That's a story.
Right.
At the little kid being at a wake.
Wow.
Uncle Alvaro.
How old were you when that happened?
Wow.
I was under 10.
Yeah, it's funny how that stuff stays.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to him? Did he go back in?
He didn't have pants on.
Are you serious?
I don't remember
that. Wow. All right, that took a weird turn, Wendy.
That did, Wendy.
It started out
early
weird
in the morning.
And then got crazy
talking
weirder.
About naked chess earlier.
Yeah,
so I don't think
really.
It's that weird.
We got all this food here, and then Wendy ruined it.
Yeah, I know. All right, we'll talk more about First Person Live in just a minute. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. The name of the show is First Person Live. You can see it in Arlington Heights in the Shakespearean district of Arlington Heights. Chip Brooks is here, the owner of Hey Nani, the venue by which you can see First Person Live. My friend Jimmy Corain, comedian, improviser, podcast host. and Diane Castile, the producer and director of First Person Live. What's the difference in somebody doing this, telling their story this way, Diane, as opposed to your more traditional, like, stand-up comedy? What do you think the difference is?
Well, for one thing, these are true stories from a person's life.
Yeah.
And they have a story arc. There's a beginning, something happens, sets action in motion. Our protagonist tries to, you know, figure out that their problem in the middle of the story, and it's resolved in some way. You know, that's a classical story arc, and personal narrative storytelling follows that. Mm-hmm. It's very different than a stream of jokes or a political speech or, you know, even an essay type of format. So I curate the show to make sure we actually have stories, and that's one reason submissions are so important.
Yeah.
And hasn't stand-up changed quite a bit, too? Before, it was a lot of set-up punchline. I know you did it, but now it's so much more personal, I feel. You always tell stories about your life and stuff, but I just feel like it's gone to another level.
Sure.
It's deeper than it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. You've been doing this for 10 years now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Has this art form changed in the decade or so that you've been doing it?
Only in the sense that more and more people are getting involved and stepping up and sharing their stories, because they're learning you really don't have to be a professional to do this. You just have to be a human being that's lived a life.
Right.
And will take some time to craft an experience into a story.
And the audience recognizes the honesty. There's no way to not recognize when something is just so blatantly honest.
For sure. You absolutely.
Yeah.
Plus the whole line about, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction.
Yes.
Some of this stuff is so crazy. You know it's true because nobody would make this stuff up. It's too unbelievable.
Right. Do some of these stories change? Like, if somebody's got a story that's just a great story, like Jimmy's story about the funeral, do you see it change and evolve as time goes on? If they've done it in front of an audience, after a while, they realize what works and what doesn't work, and they kind of hone it a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have stories that I, you know, wrote 10 years ago that I'm still telling today, but every time I get up on stage to tell that story, whether it's my show or another show, because I also perform in the city, it's always a different story.
Sure.
Slightly changed, but always different and evolving.
It's pretty interesting, and Chip, this is a great idea to have something. Live music is one thing, and I love going to see live music, but to go see First Person Live, is it like the first Tuesday of every month? Is there just a set thing?
It's going to be, I think, the second Tuesday of just about every month, and I think we're doing it every month except January. Mm-hmm. But we've got all sorts of other things going on at Hey Nanny. We do a great brunch every weekend, of course, with live music. We have bluegrass music on Saturdays and jazz on Sundays. Mm. So I think it's like the coolest live music brunch in Chicago.
Very good.
And Bill, Chip brought some food.
Oh,
what'd
Chip,
you bring up
that
here?
That was so nice of you.
Man, our chef, Tony Hernandez, is here, and he brought some great food. We've got our classic burger here with the dark buns. For those of you who like dark buns, we've got them. They're
so
really
you're
good.
Saying that's a rye bun?
It is a rye bun.
Yeah.
So,
Jimmy,
you're allowed to eat it, Jimmy.
That's great. That's right.
Jimmy had to check.
Jimmy does a booth at Great America where he identifies various types of bread.
It's weird. It was really slow this
without
summer.
Without tasting it,
right.
too.
He just looks at
like
it.
An uncanny ability. How long have you been able to do this? This is fascinating.
Well, it's been my seventh summer.
Wow.
It's really good.
Imagine that.
The gluten-free stuff kind of tricks me a little, but I'm pretty good at that.
You're going to branch out into spreads eventually, I would guess.
I will, if I get permission.
At some point,
So we've got some great chicken wings that are one of our specialties here, and then we've got a jar. We've got a couple of things that we do in jars, and the one that we've got here is a trout and blueberry jar. Spread it out on some cool rye bread or pumpernickel.
Yeah, this is a toasted pumpernickel.
There you go.
Get it right?
Got it.
All right.
Totally good. And then we also have an edamame hummus over there. We've got free-range edamame, but they're not kept in cages anywhere. But it's really a beautiful, healthy dish. And the last thing we've got is a spinach and artichoke dip.
With bruschetta, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, excellent. Jimmy, now you're
thank
off.
You.
Amazing.
Now thank you. The season's
off.
Almost over, but I still have it.
Look at you.
You got your game going.
We talked to you a little bit when you were up last time, Jimmy, but this always fascinates me. In your show, you talk about the differences of yourself and others like you, if there's such a thing, where you recognize the fact that you had a certain relationship with your parents where you were the child, but now that you have a child of your own, you're the same person, but you're a different person. I love you. I love when you talk about this.
Yeah, I think a lot of it for me is like not trying to make the same mistakes that I did as my parents. And I will have, like I will with my daughter, she's three now, Betsy, I will say like, I want to say no to something, or I get really, you know, meltdowns, man, are something new at three. That, and I want to react the same way as I do my parents. And I've just, I catch myself most of the time.
Yeah.
We were talking with Dr. John Duffy earlier.
Love Dr. John.
He's great. It's hard to be a parent. When I was pregnant with my first kid, there was a coworker I had and a woman who was older than I was and said, you just love them and try your best. And really, those are the only two ingredients.
Yeah, and the thing that I've experienced, and I don't know you guys as parents, is like the emotions you feel are so intense. Like the joy is like overwhelming,
sure.
And then the anger, like when they don't do something you want, and it's late at night, and they're supposed to get out of the tub, and they've been there for an hour.
And they're all pruny.
Yeah, and they're all pruny, and they don't understand. I mean, it's just really, really intense. And I'm really grateful that I'm in a lot of therapy, been in a lot of therapy, and that I can say to my daughter, oh, so you're angry about that, you know? Yeah.
Why don't you want to get out of the tub?
Why don't you want to get out of
the tub? Does she get out?
Yeah, on that, no, she doesn't. That just takes force. That just takes choices. You go, hey, do you want to get out yourself or you want me to get you out?
Right.
You know? And usually you get her out then?
No, she usually gets out by herself.
Oh,
she's very determined, yeah. She's very. I'm not worried about her needs being met in when she gets older.
But there's a lot of negotiating that I don't remember being there when I was the kid part of this equation. But as an adult, you find yourself a lot of negotiating going on.
Yeah, definitely a lot of negotiating and a lot of, you know, trying to do it differently than your parents did.
You want to take things from your parents and say, I think they did this right, so I'll try to carry that tradition on, but I don't think they did this right, so I'll change that. Right.
So, it's about 90% that they didn't do right. And that 10%, if you can find it, I haven't found it yet, Bill, but when you can find it, it's there somewhere.
My favorite line is, wait till you have kids of your own.
Oh, I used to get that all the time, and it would drive me nuts.
They were right, though, weren't they?
Yeah, they were absolutely right, because you can't prepare. No, you can't prepare for having a kid.
Yeah.
Go see First Person Live. It's playing at Hey Nani in Arlington Heights. The best way to reach you guys is through the website or the phone number. The phone number is 224-202-0750. The website
is heynani.com.
Spell that out, Chip.
HEYNONNY.
Very
it's
nice.
It's from Shakespeare, you know.
It's from Shakespeare.
We also have a website, which is firstpersonlive.com. So
perfect name for it,
you can find the schedule for upcoming months, the themes, the dates, and submit a story if you want.
Excellent.
I will be at one of them 100%.
Wendy's coming
out. I gotta go.
And I'll still be at Great America until 2 weeks from now. So bring your bread on up. Any dough product, I'd be happy to.
I've won so many stuffed animals from you. It's insane. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Diane. Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks, Chip. Really appreciate you being here.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Ryan Burrow from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here, 720 WGN.